Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit and nonpartisan forum open to the public. To attend a Commonwealth Club event, check out our program listing at www.commonwealthclub.org. Now we join today's program of the Commonwealth Club.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's Commonwealth Club Inform meeting with author Alan Kaufman. Alan Kaufman's restless quest for Jewish identity has taken him from the front lines of the Arab-Israeli conflict to Dachau concentration camp, to the streets of New York, to the San Francisco underground. The Bronx-born son of a Holocaust survivor as well as an Israeli army veteran, Kaufman reports from the visceral core of modern Jewish experience and has been compared to such figures as Jack Kerouac, Norman Mailer, Jean Genet, and Henry Miller. In this evening, Alan Kaufman, a powerful and entertaining reader, will take us on his Jewish journey through excerpts from Matches, Jew Boy, as well as his poetry and essays. There will be an audience question-answer period after the reading. Please welcome Alan Kaufman.
I've also been compared to my Uncle Arnold, but I won't tell you what he's famous for. Thank you very, very much for coming today. It's a great pleasure to be here. A couple of people have worked very hard for this event, and I want to thank Nicole Grant of the Commonwealth Club for having me, and also Tracy Thomas, who really is a dynamo from Beit Shalom Shul. I see some faces here from there. So I want to thank her and all of you from Beit Shalom for coming. So tonight I'm going to take us on a little journey, my Jewish journey, through my writings. I'll read some excerpts from essays and some poems and also from my memoir, Jew Boy. And also from my recently published novel, Matches. I thought I would begin with an essay that I published in the Chronicle a couple of years ago about Isaac Beshevet Singer, about a meeting that I had with Mr. Singer when I was a young college student and was plagued by the problem of always writing about Jewish themes. I was even advised by college professors that that would not stand me in good stead as a writer, that publishers, as a rule, tend to shy away from too much Jewish stuff in the writing, and was advised to not do that. And yet, for all the well-meaning advice that I'd been handed by my professors, I was, in fact, cursed with Jewish writer-itis. Whenever I set pen to page, out popped some Jewish character anguishing over the Holocaust. I felt like a throwback to another age, a young has-been, irrelevant. I wasn't hip. I was obsessed with Auschwitz. My fellow writers effulged in prose about smoking pot and free love. But I wrote about a lonely Jewish survivor who spoke to his goldfish and a dreamy sculptor who perished in the gas chambers. And to make matters worse, I launched, with my own meager resources, a Jewish literary magazine. Surely I was destined by the standards of the day to commit professional suicide. I felt that only Isaac Beshevet Singer would understand, know what I should do. And so one day, I phoned. His number, like that of no other well-known writer of the time, was listed. Famous for taking strangers' calls, he answered, "Yes," in a thick accent. "Who is this?" "Alan Kaufman," I said. "How can I help you, Mr. Kaufman?" "Mr. Singer," I began, heart racing, "I'm a college-aged writer, a novice. I publish a Jewish magazine. My mother was in the Holocaust. My great-uncle was Abraham Kahan, who founded the Jewish Daily Forward, the Yiddish newspaper where you still publish all your stories and novels before they get translated into English." There was a tired pause. Your mother, she was in the war? Yes, I said. And you are a relation of Gahan? Yes, I said nervously, from a side of the family he despised. Another pause, this one kinder somehow. I see, and so I can help you with something? Please, may I come see you? He considered then. So, come, the address you know. I read it off the telephone directory listing. Good, you'll be here soon. He seemed almost concerned for me. Right now, I said. I'm in the building on the left, he said, off the courtyard. Goodbye. I lived only a short 30 blocks away, not too far for a 19-year-old to run in fry boots with worn-through soles that made my socks kiss the pavement. And when I reached his amazing building on West 86th Street, a giant wedding cake of a thing with a doorman in a booth, I gasped, "Here for Singer!" and was waved right through. By the gloomy lobby lights, I searched the mailboxes, and there, incredibly, affixed to the dented brass lid was the name I.B. Singer and his apartment number. He met me dressed in the white shirt and black tie, trousers and shoes that had become his trademark. He swayed a bit unsteadily, as the old do. "Come in," he said, and turned and led the way into his bedroom, where an open valise lay on the bed. "Alma, my wife, is already down in Miami. I'm flying tonight to join her." "I shouldn't be a pest," I said. "I can come another time." "At my age, there is no other time," he said. "Have a seat." I sat on the edge of the bed as often in childhood. I would perch on my mother's bed while she showed me photos of the family she'd lost in the war, lifting out each one from a valise, just like Singer's. "And so, what is your trouble?" he asked. I hadn't said anything about trouble, yet he knew. And so I told him about my obsession with the Holocaust, that I felt alone, not only as a writer, but even among American Jews, like a ghost, separate, inhabiting a kingdom of the dead, unseen by the living, one made up of the murdered Jewish communities of Europe. I said that in my prose, I wrote more for the dead than for the living. He listened intently while slowly folding and packing shirts. And when I had finished, he looked at me carefully and said, "You were born here in America?" "Yes, in New York, but how I ended up among the living, I don't know. I really shouldn't be alive," he nodded. "This is because your mother was a survivor. She felt guilty and you took this on yourself from her. You might be right. Perhaps you are a ghost. I too believe in spirits. This is something we both share. But you should also know that in Jewish tradition, when a funeral meets a wedding in the road, the wedding has the right of way. Life comes first. So, you brought me something to see what you wrote? Most young writers do." Ashamed, I nodded and handed him a copy of my magazine containing what I considered my best short story, of course, about Jews. After all, the only reason for a broke young student to publish a magazine is to feature one's favorite author, oneself. This is from a chapter called Bar Mitzvah in my memoir, Jew Boy. On the night before my bar mitzvah, my father went to his night shift job as usual, but promised to return early for the ceremony. Howie, my brother, went to bed, and my mother and I stayed up late, poring over the snapshots of the dead in her special valise full of photographs. It lay open between us on the bed. I felt so much hope on the eve of this important occasion, more hope than the world had in itself to fulfill. "You don't know," she said, "how I prayed for this day after the war, to see a son bar mitzvahed, This would be my answer to Hitler. I smiled. Are you proud of me, Mom? Proud? She stopped, choked with emotion. Tears rose in her during the silent, perfectly still interval. And then she sobbed with tears in her eyes. Of course I'm proud. Do you think I ever dreamed I would live to see this day when I was hiding all those years from the Nazis? Any new day brought a death warrant. There was a price on my head. I was a Jew. Do you understand? 13 years old, your age, and they wanted to kill me. The floodgates burst, she cried. I waited, used to her tears. I looked around me at the drab, aqua-colored walls and chintzy furnishings from Castro's and Macy's and Alexander's. Beyond the imprisoning slats of sealed Venetian blinds was an air shaft in which the bedroom window across the way framed the fleshy white figure of an old woman who sat there in her slip day and night in all kinds of weather, ghostly behind a pane of sooty glass, motionless and staring at God knows what. I remembered photographs I had seen of Hitler's Nazi empire, the mass torchlight rallies of pale, wild-faced, spotlighted against pitch-black night, the leaping light from the flames spurting in their lustrously manic eyes, crowds of these faces in the thousands and tens of thousands with demonic formations of black-uniformed robotic SS, goose-stepping right off the page, and of Nazi chieftains, always laughing with hyena grins of absolute certainty. I had seen austere, terrifying, massive buildings of Nazi administration and Nazi battle formations of tanks and bombers and SS soldiers confidently inching forward in the face of machine guns and, again, the leering grins of soldiers tossing a border gate aside and convening heads of state, Roosevelt, Stalin, Churchill, meeting to discuss ways to overthrow the madmen, and the pictures of the camps, the ones I found more and more of in the Grand Concourse Public Library, in books and magazines, my silent air of respectful shock upon first encountering the walking corpse gaping at me through a camera lens, asking me, are these my eyes real to you? Are these my bones real to you? Does your heart admit to the possibility of such things? What does your mind make of such a world in which people can do this to others without the interference of anyone, God or man? And slamming shut the book each time, returning it hurriedly to its place on the shelf in a panic, stuffing it back, not wanting to see it anymore or ever again, I returned to the novel section. Ernest Hemingway, Thomas Wolfe, James Jones, they were safe, their easy world of sad stone angels and disillusioned fighting men in love with their nurses. It was difficult to connect the grainy pictures of the Nazi past to my mother, flabby with purple scars across her belly, scars she sometimes showed me from the emergency cesarean of my difficult, life-threatening birth. It was hard to see the victory over Hitler in this stuffy Bronx bedroom with steam pipes knocking and footsteps creaking overhead and the neighbors' raised, quarreling voices through the paper-thin walls and the old woman's ghostly stare at an alley wall, or to understand how I, in a Barney's Big Men's Shop maroon-colored husky boy's suit with poor grades and bad hygiene and flat-top crew-cut gawking ugliness could be an answer to the horrors of the past. But she said it with so much conviction, so much absolute conviction, that I believed her and rose and said good night and kissed her on the top of her frizzy head, which ducked tortoise-like between her shoulders, and plodded out to strip off my pants and lie in the dark, listening to my brother snore in the next bed and wondering at the poverty of God's miracles. Thank you. So I grew up. And I wrote poetry, and in the early 90s, I was invited to Germany to read my poetry. Of course, I didn't want to go. But a very good friend of mine, whose opinion I respect, said, "You really have to go. It's just too extraordinary, the thought that you, of all people, have been invited to come read poetry in Germany. You have to go." So I went. In Munich, this was published in the old San Francisco Examiner. In Munich, Frankfurt, Hamburg, and Berlin, audiences and media turned out to hear my poetry in a way that I have yet to experience in the United States. Germans love American poets. On television, before an audience of 60 million viewers, I performed "Who Are We?", my poem about the need that I feel as the son of a survivor to bear a message of social justice. But off mic, when I spoke further of the Holocaust, eyes turned hard. Conversation abruptly changed. Germans give the definite impression that they are sick and tired of hearing about all that. Their attitude toward the worst crime in human history, like that of people living near the site of a popular tourist attraction, a kind of blasé weariness. So on performance tour, I led two lives, by night hanging out with the literary avant-garde, and by day visiting different sites of Nazi destruction. I saw deserted cemeteries with defiled, toppled stones and gutted synagogues still undergoing reconstruction 50 years after Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. And yet, for the most part, I got along just fine with Germans of my generation. Some cared. Werner, who took me to see the museum of the former Gestapo headquarters, burst into tears when he discovered in the sign-in guest book the words, "Hitler was right," left by the last visitor. I was less surprised. But the hardy seniors whom one sees everywhere with their snow-white hair and smug blue eyes sparked rage in me, which I struggled to conceal. "What did you do in the war?" I wondered. And there was that doddering old man in Frankfurt who knew at once that I was an American Jew and seemed to come all alive on the quaint street, screaming in good English, "Jew filth, American kike," and so on. Then lapsed back into a senile fog. As he wasn't long for this world, I let death respond for me. In East Berlin, my well-meaning hosts led me into districts riddled with bullet holes. Here, smiling, long-haired young squatters worked at regentrifying ruins into architects' offices and underground discotheques. My guts wrenched as my hosts nonchalantly announced, "This was a Jewish quarter before the war." Sure enough, I saw on a brick wall a faded advertisement for Goldstein's Furs, and further on another for Cohen's Bookstore. Gritting my teeth, I wondered, where is Goldstein? Where is Cohen? As I walked the Judenrein streets of the New Germany, like a ghost of Europe's vanished Jews, as I watched these smiling, long-haired youths with crowbars tearing up the flagstones of old Jewish streets to plant gardens and build playgrounds, I thought, maybe Hitler has won his war against us after all. Around this time, I began to explore the matter of my Jewish faith. In earnest, visiting synagogues around the Bay Area. And I went to every single synagogue in the Bay Area, every single one, even to Beit Shalom. But somehow couldn't find my niche, and finally I arrived in the Richmond district at this little synagogue, and I went in. And it was populated by a small group of Holocaust survivors with numbers on their arms, many of them with numbers on their arms. So I sat in the back with my long hair and my earring and my torn jeans, digging on the situation, you know, feeling good. And in the middle of the ceremony, a little old lady came up to me and said, young man, would you mind terribly carrying the Torah for us? None of us can pick it up. It's so heavy. So I was like, sure. I had never done that before in my entire life. And so I took out the Torah. I carried around. You know, they were kissing the Torah with the talisim and singing. And it was amazing, you know. And people were patting me on the back and go, you're a real shtaka, a real shtaka. And I put it back. The ceremony ended. And I left. I was about to leave. And I thought, that's it, you know. I've done my Jewish religious thing. And they all crowded around me and said, could you come back next week and do it again? So I ended up going back and doing it for 4 years. You know, Jewish guilt really works. And I wrote a poem. I got actually, you know, on the inside track of this shul. And there was a fellow, Norman, a dentist, who used to come and pick us up in his BMW, pick up a small elite select group of the inside track people, and take us to shul. So I wrote this poem about it called 2020 after the TV show. As usual, Norman, the retired dentist, is driving us all to shul. Me in the front seat of his BMW, sad-eyed Rosa in back with her tattooed arm and deliciously mysterious smile. And on a Saturday like this, as we drive through the Richmond district of San Francisco with the indigo sky trembling like a tincture of blue on a laboratory slide, it's hard to imagine that the notorious Dr. Joseph Mengele, Auschwitz's angel of death, once used Rosa for a human guinea pig because of her blue eyes. Or that Norman, so lively, brusque, and friendly, is dying of prostate cancer. All right, never mind. It's a beautiful day. And so now we stop to pick up Shirley, all 91 years of her. Kind of horror. May she live to be 120, but where is she? We peer into the dark space of her open garage. She's sitting in her car, I bet, to keep warm, guesses Norman. And sure enough, outlined against her windshield, her feathery white hair appears, and from the car's abruptly open door, an orthopedic shoe touches earth, then another. And she is hobbling quickly towards us, clutching her famous handbag, the one with her name Shirley repeated endlessly across the front, so that I can't forget my name, and neither should you. With suave grace, I slip out and open for her the door. She refuses help into her seat, but looks up with her slanted red mouth like an ironically placed comma and says, thank you, honey. And we're off again. And as usual, someone asks, did anyone see 2020 last night? You mean, says Rosa, about the Frenchman was married to a Japanese woman, turned out was a man and had a baby by her or him? It was so confusing. Can you believe that idiot, growls Norman, of all the stupid people in the world? And he was a diplomat to boot. Ah, says Shirley, that I don't mind so much, but what did you think the story of that woman that cut off her husband's penis? How impoverished I feel, who from principled cultural pride refuses to own a television or watch such programs. Instead, at home with classical music turned up high, I compose sterile, empty poems about how moths immolating themselves on light bulbs are like poets drawn ineffably to death as though it were a light. But just see what I'm missing. Yes, Rosa agrees, that was a crazy story. But the Frenchman having baby, the Japanese man, was the craziest story I ever heard. How could he not know? I gasp shyly. That's the point, says Rosa. The Japanese man had his genitals removed, and he had some way of tucking his penis into the hole where his scrotum used to be. I dare not even turn around to look her in the eyes as she speaks of such things. I'm blushing from ear to ear, me, the hotshot radical underground poet who prides himself upon his association with shadowy subterraneans of the counterculture. Uh-huh, I say nervously. Uh-huh. As we sail beneath a canopy of trees. Yes, says Rosa, with an air of exquisite European refinement. So when they made love, the Frenchman could not tell the difference. He must have been a virgin. And even then, I wonder in this day and age, with so much sex lib, how he could not know the difference. He was an idiot, snapped Shirley. Stupidest human being I ever saw, roars Norman. Yes, says Rosa, I agree. But it was all a trick the Japanese man played. He had a baby by another marriage with a woman, and so one day he told the Frenchman, here, I gave birth to your son. And the Frenchman bought it. I nearly beat my head on the dashboard for the sheer stupidity of the Frenchman. And where's the Japanese man now, I demanded to know. Divorced, said Rosa, dancing and singing in the chorus of Madame Butterfly. And she said it as though this were the most perfectly logical outcome in the world. And as I glanced at the numbers on her arm, tattooed at Auschwitz, suddenly it all was logical. As one by one, the numerals seemed to rise from her skin, expand, grow wings, lift off like butterflies, and flutter out the window into the Sabbath afternoon. Thank you. This is from the afterword to my novel Matches, which is about Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip. I served in the Gaza Strip. I served in Zahal. I made Aliyah. I lived in Israel for 7 years. And I served for a number of years in the IDF. I served as recently as 2003. And went in years ago to do my first service in Sadir and then later in Milouim, in the regular army and then in the reserves. I persuaded a major daily newspaper to accredit me with the Israeli government as a foreign correspondent and flew to Israel at the height of the suicide bombings to cover the war that had come to be known as the War of the Buses. In 2002, I found a country steeped in terror and gloom. Jerusalem, my old hometown, was deserted. Walking its streets reawakened in me many, many memories of events that are portrayed in Matches. I saw the sprawling house in Katamon, where I lived in a rented room with a wide veranda, next to the old Kurdistani woman who had accidentally set herself on fire. In its large courtyard still sat old Iraqi Jewish women making apricot leather in big metal pans. I saw the Stakeyas on Agrippa Street, where so often I went drinking and dancing late at night with fellow artists and writers. I walked alone with press badge prominently displayed in the old city of Jerusalem, in the Arab Quarter, where, in happier days, my friends and I would move in a lively shoulder-to-shoulder crush of tourists, shopping for bargains in the crowded stalls. This was followed by a sumptuous dining on lamb and rice in a Palestinian restaurant. But now there was not a tourist in sight. I was advised by a squad of militant young Palestinians to return to the Jewish quarter or else. At the Wailing Wall, normally a swarm with festive visitors, the only people in evidence were armed soldiers and a handful of somber old religionists. I also saw something I'd never seen before. In the town center on Ben Yehuda Street, the most popular party street in Jerusalem, and so the hardest hit by suicide bombings, the sidewalks were eerily quiet, the shops empty, but on the street corners were musicians, violinists, cellists, and flutists, young and old, figures out of a Chagall painting, who stood there serenely playing classical music, Mozart and Brahms and Bach, serenading the desertion. Their playing, they explained, was an affirmation against death. everywhere I went in Jerusalem, armed guards frisked me at the doors of coffee shops and restaurants. In the streets and on buses, people looked anxious, shell-shocked. I had never before seen Israel like this. I hadn't been in touch with the military side of life for some time, but now I visited IDF units in the West Bank and interviewed settlers, Palestinians, and also the families of Israeli teenagers who had been killed by suicide bombers. One of the Jewish mothers I interviewed showed me albums of photographs of her 16-year-old daughter, a talented guitarist who died in the bombing of the Sparrow Pizzeria in the center of Jerusalem. The suicide bomber had entered, she said, bearing his nail bomb in a guitar case. He had stood, according to the forensic reports, right next to her daughter, who also bore an instrument case, though hers contained a guitar. The bomber, she explained, had detonated right next to her daughter. She showed me a photo taken of her dead daughter's face as it looked after the blast. It was completely flattened. "You know," this mother told me, "you don't stop loving your child just because her face looks like this in death. Even this face you love. And I look at this photo with as much love as all the others." From the Los Angeles Times. Meet Malki's mother, Frimit Roth. Roth lives in Ramot, a stark housing development baking on the hills that swell Jerusalem's northern approaches. Despite its nearness to the city's heart, the nondescript suburb is, by Palestinian definition, over the Green Line, a West Bank settlement. It is ostensibly because of places like this that suicide bombers like Izzeddine Masri, the Hamas operative from Jenin, who blew himself up at the Sparrow restaurant, feels justified to take innocent lives. In her flat, Roth knows exactly how to begin our conversation. She goes into another room and brings back a picture of her daughter, Malki, and her friend Michal, then studies it before handing it to me. "This is them," she says. They appear like so many girlfriends of that age, complimentary. Malki, the fair-haired dreamer, dark-haired Michal, more down to earth. Each smiles brightly, as if dazzled by all the promise they embodied. We look at the photograph, discuss how beautiful the girls are. Roth begins speaking of a daughter. "She was a very unusual child in that she had high ideals which she strove always to live up to. 3 weeks before her murder, she had volunteered in a camp up north for handicapped kids. Always musical, Malki had lately played a guitar on loan from her school. Her friends," said her mother, "told me afterward that she would take it out on the bus to school and play. Michal also played guitar. They would all sing. She was a dream of a child. The worst thing she did was mess up her room." During the final year of her life, Malki, like all Israelis, had to cope with the rising tide of violence. "There was death all around her," said her mother. "She thought about it a lot. Every day were new terrorist attacks. In her diary, she marked them down with the names of their victims, their ages, details of what happened, as if she knew them. Some of her friends traveled each day on a road where there was constant shooting. Sometimes they stayed here overnight because it was unsafe to return home. One of them told her, 'I kiss my parents each morning before school because I'm not sure I'll see them at night.'" Still, her mother says, Malki never imagined that she was going to an unsafe place when she went to Sparrow Pizzeria. On the day of the bombing, Malki and Michal went to see a friend who just returned home from overseas. Then they headed for a meeting of summer camp youth leaders. On the way, apparently, the girls decided to stop off for pizza. "When I saw the news of the bombing on television," her mother recalls, "I didn't worry about her because I thought she had already gone to the meeting." Reflexively, she placed a call to her daughter's cell phone. Knowing how the volume of cell phone calls after a bombing can overwhelm the system, Roth didn't think much about not being able to reach her daughter. But by late afternoon, she had grown anxious. It was unlike Malki not to check in to reassure her mother that everything was okay. "I called up the summer camp office to see if she'd arrived for the meeting. They said she hadn't. Now I truly worried, Roth recalls. I went to the hospital with my neighbor Aviva, Michal's mother, and on the way, Aviva got a call from her other children who said a friend had told them that Malki had called earlier to say, meet us at Sparrow. Michal and I are going there for a bite before the meeting. When I heard this, I began screaming and crying. I knew. From Matches. The Orchard. That morning when it was done, when we were sickened unto death and curfew reigned, we tore our helmets off and sped through the riot streets of shattered glass over blood-spattered flagstones. Past bullet-punched walls we flew. The boiling black smoke pillars of burning tires stalked us like the desert god. Our wheels scattered spent shells, crimson rocks. Here and there, one of our cousins, as we called the local Arabs, curled in a doorway, defiant, weeping with rage, his keffiyeh clenched in his teeth. The air reeked of camel shit and dread. My sleepless eyes drifted shut. On their side, six shot, no telling how many dead, and from our end, two wounded, bad, and one, curly-headed Ruvi, the newlywed, begged for a grave. Only 24 he was, the boy. A mob-tossed hand grenade mangled his guts. A bad scene. My mouth yawned wide to gulp the morning air, and my filthy fingers pried my eyes apart. I was no boy and needed strong mud coffee. But we did not stop. We could not. Neither did we take the patrol route back to base. We fled town. Good riddance. The blurred green-black road trembled, the sun risen over us with an ill-sounding bird song. Sometimes a song can sound diseased. We stopped our ears. I put my fists to mine. I shook. Then our armored car swerved sharply, and Brandt shouted something indecipherable, and we stumbled through a vineyard into a clearing. At the end of the road it was, in a grove of olive trees. Right there we pulled off the red clay and onto the thick brown grass, and stopped. Brandt and Ori jumped out, dropped their guns to the ground, shrugged off their gear, threw themselves down and passed out, clutching the grass like a woman's hair. Groggily, I followed suit. The last thing I saw before sleep was a giant black fly stropping its legs on my hand. I was the first to awaken to see the old Palestinian. My eyes snapped from him to the weapons in back. He held out apples, said something. I didn't care what he said. Climbing casually to my feet, I walked with a fiercely pounding heart to the guns, shouldered mine, and collecting the others, deposited them next to my sleeping comrades, whom I brought awake with sharp kicks. The Palestinian took in all of this. When Uri talked to him in perfect Arabic, the old man listened carefully, his black clotted eyes mucle with age. His thin, frowning face had a prominent square jaw covered with gray thistles. His apricot-colored skin was mapped with 1,000 prehistoric wadis. An aura of bandoliers and virgin brides hung about him, and scores of grandchildren playing in his ravines. Then he spoke, his hands gesturing with strong, graceful motions that trembled for age. When he finished, he looked around at us and nodded to each emphatically, slapping the back of one hand against the palm of the other again and again. He says, Uri began, that his name is Jamal Abu Dawud, that we are guests on his farm, that we are in an orchard here planted by his own hands. His wife is dead. His daughter's all married. He has lived here since infancy. Once we should eat his fruit, ours to heat, he says. Says that we have nothing to fear. Uri paused, then. And he says that he knows that our peoples are at war, that he has seen what his own people do, and he knows the war they make is cruel. And he has also seen Israeli soldiers like us come and go and what we do. He thinks everyone has gone crazy. But that is out there, he says, beyond the orchard, and not here. He encourages us to eat our fill before we go. He wishes us a good rest. Eat up quick, and let's get the hell out of here before he returns with friends, says Brandt, our sergeant. He spits in the dust and adds, murdering old son of a bitch. Hurriedly, we fill our apple helmet with apples, jump aboard the armored car, and roar off. They all have guns hidden someplace, even an old man like that. How good is your Arabic, Brandt snarled at Uri, whom we knew to be a real peacenik. I think you made up that old man's speech. We laughed, Uri too. We were so dead tired. True or not about Uri's little speech, we all feared our return to the city of graves where more rioting loomed. But even as we laughed in despair, we peered back hard at the old man's groves. We no longer searched for his gun muzzles flash, but watched his trees recede, growing smaller and smaller, his world disappearing. And even now, long after it has vanished altogether, still we glance back to there, or what we think is there, so far away. We look with a sense of longing and regret, though that too is fast fading. I'm going to finish with a piece from today's Los Angeles Times that I wrote, called Hamas Can't Let Israel Go. Nearly 10 months after Israel withdrew every last soldier, settler, nail, and bucket from Gaza, the Hamas-led Palestinians can't seem to let go. There is something psychologically profound about Hamas abducting to Gaza and holding hostage an Israeli soldier, 19-year-old Corporal Gilad Shalit. You would think that the very last thing the Palestinians would want to import to Gaza is precisely the emblem of their former occupation, a soldier. And yet, on a psychological plane, this seemingly senseless political act may be symbolically important. Perhaps without the soldier in their midst, the Palestinians in and of themselves feel no existential purpose. Perhaps they have no way to establish their own sense of destiny without the perpetual agony of conflict with Israel. Hamas literally needs an occupier enemy, just as released convicts who can't seem to make it on the outside intentionally commit crimes in order to be returned to prison, where they feel safer and better understand the rules. How else to explain the barrage of Qassam rockets from Gaza at Israel's populated areas, even after Israel has evacuated the Palestinians' land? How else to fathom the pointless murder of a West Bank settler, 18-year-old Eliyahu Asheri, killed almost immediately following his abduction? Each rocket, each murder, is a painful tap on Israel's shoulder from a frustrated former marriage partner who cannot let go and is threatening homicide. I'm still here, proclaims each explosion. Take me back, each murder demands. Unfortunately, Israel, cannot take out a restraining order against Hamas. To some Americans, Israel's unfolding military strike on the Gaza Strip in response to Shalit's kidnapping may seem like an overreaction, no less irrational than the behavior of the other side. After all, Americans may think it's just one soldier. Four, and sometimes eight times as many U.S. soldiers die in Iraq and Afghanistan each day, their deaths hardly noted. But in Israel, the loss by death or abduction of a single soldier is an utterly devastating national event. As a veteran of the Israel Defense Forces who served extensively in the Gaza Strip, I remember how, strolling Jerusalem's streets on leave from my military service, I saw the glow of a television set in every window. I heard the same newscaster's voice multiplied and amplified throughout the city as he read the roll call of the day's casualties. Israelis sat huddled and still, with hands over mouths, suppressing shock. Occasionally, there were actual cries, as though some mother in her flat felt the loss of the soldiers as her very own children. This is an aspect of Israel that is rarely talked about, a side not portrayed in Steven Spielberg's and Tony Kushner's cynical film, Munich. Its source is a deeply Jewish perspective that holds that the loss of a single Jewish life is equal to that of an entire universe, the code of a people who to this day remember the anonymous graves of 6 million Jews, including 1 million children, killed in the Holocaust. Where is Corporal Shalit? Is he alive? Today, not only Israelis, but Jews everywhere, from San Francisco to Paris to Tel Aviv, are praying for his safe return. And there is anger in our prayers, reflected in the Israeli response, which reflects our deep sense of betrayal over the refusal by the Hamas-led Palestinian government to accept the existence of the Jewish state. It has become abundantly clear since the Israeli withdrawal from Gaza and the advent of the Hamas government that not even disengagement is enough. Hamas, like a jilted homicidal lover, will not rest until Israel is destroyed. Thank you. So,
for the radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club's Inform program, and tonight we're talking with Alan Kaufman, author of Jew Boy and most recently Matches. So now we're going to go to the audience question Q&A portion, so please line up at this mic, ask any question you like, and we'll start now.
And if you don't ask questions, I'll ask questions of myself. I'm a self-questioner.
What did you hope to achieve by serving in the Israeli army several times?
I served, you are drafted. I was drafted. And my intention was to defend the Jewish state. Yes, ma'am. What was his response? You know, that's very interesting. He never wrote back. I was too shy to call him. I expected a written response or something or a call to say, you're going to win the Nobel Prize. But it didn't come. No, I never heard back from him again. It might help if someone takes the microphone around and...
Can't pass. I do have a question of my own. You're a poet, you're a novelist. What is your favorite form?
My favorite genre?
Yes.
That's difficult to say. Certainly the most difficult genre is prose, you know, the long book. It takes a while to write one of those. I think the poem is easiest for me. I seem to toss them off pretty easily. So I wouldn't say it's my favorite form, but it's certainly the easier.
I also heard that you started being a poet in kindergarten. Would you tell us about that?
Now, how did you find out about that?
I read it in an interview.
I'm sorry?
I read it in an interview.
Oh, you read that in an interview. Well, it's true. When I was 5 years old, I wrote my first poem. It was something, I don't even recall, something about the snow is like confetti or something like that, and my teacher just raved about it. She said, this is a poem. Do you realize you've written a poem? And I hadn't. I hadn't realized. My mother taught me to read and write when I was very, very young. Much before I got to kindergarten, I was reading and writing. And she really drilled into me how important the writer is. It's important to be a writer. You know, she really made me feel that that was an important thing to do. Later, of course, she recanted, as all good Jewish mothers must once they realize their kid is going to face years of deprivation and neglect. And she would then try to persuade me, no, you must do something else and write on the side. But it was interesting, when she was dying, she said to me in her hotel room, or rather in her hospital room, she said to me, you know, it really is the most important thing to be a writer. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
The proposal of Olmert was he's going to have a withdrawal from the West Bank in the coming years because he wanted to have defensible border. In light of the reactions now of Hamas and the Gaza, isn't there a split in the Israeli population whether to proceed with that or not proceed with that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the thing about Hamas that's so interesting is that Hamas under no circumstances can or ever will accept the existence of the State of Israel in any way, manner, or form. So that's the beginning of the negotiation position. So how Olmert or any of the Israelis respond, left or right, respond to that kind of implacable fact, you know, is bound to create, I mean, we're Jews after all, a million positions, but the fact remains the same. Their agenda is entirely parallel to that of the Nazi Party. I mean, they are only for our annihilation and nothing else. Period. I mean, now, you know, what do you do with that one? Yes, sir.
Hi. I'm of German-Jewish background. I'm about to undertake a trip to Berlin this summer.
A Yekke.
I've heard that word before. It wasn't one I'm familiar with.
That's it.
Do you think you could speak a little bit more about your impressions of Germany and of the current generation of Germans?
Yes.
As regarding the Jews and the Holocaust.
Yes. You know, it's very interesting. When I was in Berlin on my last reading tour there, I was there with Allen Ginsberg and Kathy Acker and others. And we were invited to the Turkish consulate because the Germans, neo-Nazis, were killing Turkish immigrants left, right, and center. They were burning them to death in their homes in these skinhead riots. So we had gone to Berlin to both celebrate California Jewish culture, but the Turkish government had asked if we would come to the consulate and make statements, each one opposing these actions of the neo-Nazis. And so when I was there, I met an American State Department official in Berlin, stationed in Berlin, Reed CIA, who, I mean, that's what they are, and who said to me, you know, so I asked him, well, what about this, you know, business? I mean, why do you think the Kohl government, you know, allows for this? Why don't they just immediately come in there and crush it? And he goes, you know, he says, I want you to know that right after World War II, our chief preoccupation was no longer the National Socialists. Our chief preoccupation were the Soviets. And we were anxious to recruit the Germans immediately to engage in warfare against the Soviets, counterintelligence and so forth. And he says the Germans were very good at that, and so we incorporated a lot of people from the former Gestapo. He said they were very, very good operatives, and we worked with them. He says, and similarly, there were many people in the German government who simply took over their old positions or got their old positions back because there was nobody else qualified to run the place, you know, to do these positions. He says, so in effect, much of the Nazi government, you know, at the lower level, remained in place. He said, there never really was this enormous kind of recanting of the National Socialist viewpoint. He said, they just simply, you know, it just kind of got hidden away and, you know, swept under the rug. It never was addressed. And to this day in Germany, in point of fact, if you speak with the leading psychologists and sociologists who appear on German television to state this, they argue that the Germans have still not come face to face with the Holocaust. They have still not grappled with it. They have still not come to any kind of resolution, if such a thing is possible, with the Holocaust. They just simply have not come to terms with it. They simply have pushed it to the side.
Hi. I'd like to know where you came up with the title of your book, Matches, because I heard from somewhere it's a good story.
Matches is the Israeli army, you know, kind of field code term that we use to call soldiers. We call them gafarim, matches. The term originally comes from a poem by Hannah Senish. Hannah Senish was a Hungarian Jew who parachuted into Hungary as part of the British, I think it was, intelligence, and was captured by the Gestapo and tortured for days without giving up the names of her operatives, without betraying anyone. The Germans admired her so much that they stopped torturing her and they just simply killed her to put her out of her suffering. She had written a poem. She was in British-occupied Palestine, and she had written a poem called Blessed is the Match. So the Israel Defense Forces initially took the term as a code name for Israeli soldiers in the field, matches. And when they were in the field, we would say to each other on the radio, you know, Yesli po shalosh gafarim, shalosh gafarim, you know, I have three matches, meaning I have three soldiers. However, over time, And, you know, with the Israeli cynical, we get a little cynical, the term came to also symbolize someone who strikes, burns, and dies quickly. So it's got two definitions. Yes, sir.
Why did you move to Israel, and why did you decide to return?
I moved to Israel. Initially, I didn't intend to move to Israel. I knew nothing about Israel. When I went to Israel, I really thought it was a desert with tents and camels, and, you know, that's what I thought it was. I remember asking my friend Alan Tannenbaum, who first told me about Israel, I said, you know, are there bookstores there? I mean, I didn't know. Should I bring a lot of books with me? And he said, don't worry, Bubala, there's bookstores there. You know, I got to Israel, I was astonished. It had an overwhelming impact on me almost immediately. As soon as I set foot on it, I was shocked. I was amazed. I mean, signs in Hebrew, people speaking Hebrew, Jews everywhere. I was overwhelmed. I loved it. I went to kibbutz. They couldn't hold me back. The kibbutzniks were trying to stop me from going into the army. They say, not liat liat, you know. You have slowly, slowly, you have time. Learn Hebrew first, and so forth. But I just couldn't bear it. I would see soldiers and want to be in the army. So I joined. And I stayed in Israel for 7 years. I served in regular army and in reserves. The war in Lebanon broke out. I served in the Gaza Strip. I served in many different places. And I was in a combat unit. And frankly, I left Israel in part because of an adulterous love affair. And this is true. And also because I was tired. I was tired of the war. I was tired of the warfare. I wanted to go back, you know, to come back and touch base and be here and so forth. And the Israeli soldiers used to say to me, you'll see, you have an out. You can leave. We can't leave. You can leave. And they were right. I used my get out card. I did. They were right.
I was interested in an interview you gave, and you responded to the reason you chose Jew Boy as a title, and you spoke, somehow you made it universalist in your response, and you spoke about the outsider and that everyone was an outsider.
Well, I do feel that we Jews are outsiders by definition. I mean, we're self-proclaimed outsiders. We don't try to recruit other people to our faith. We're not anxious to get more non-Jews to become Jews or something. We don't, you know, proselytize. The term Jew Boy, though, as I used it, has a twofold meaning. You know, where I came from in the Bronx, my father was an American Jew, my father, Bronx born, and my mother was a French Holocaust survivor. He and his friends would call each other Jew Boy in a very kind of proud and fond way. It didn't have this onerous kind of meaning. But when I went to school and in the streets of the Bronx, I found myself having to fight for my life and being called Jew Boy in a very, very derogatory way. So it's meant to imply both, to resonate with both implications.
As a veteran and all my brothers as well, I wonder if there's a resentment in Israel against those who are ultra-Orthodox or born again or whatever, who do not serve in any capacity and who live off the state subsidy, if there is a resentment by those that do serve.
You know, may I say, I don't want to really address that too directly, may I just say it's a kind of fond resentment? Yes, there is, but it's not the big issue in everyone's mind. I mean, in some people's mind it's a big issue, and certainly it's understandable, but, you know, finally, when all is said and done, they're Jews too. And what can you do? They don't want to serve, so they don't serve. Kachaze, you know?
excuse me. You've talked about the importance of the writer, as your mother explained to you. What is your definition of the importance of the writer?
Do you want me to show you my bank account? That'll answer all your questions. You know, my mother was French, and in French, the writer is held in much higher regard than he is or she is here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there's a longer tradition of veneration for the writer, you know. my definition of a writer is, I mean, it's very prosaic, is one who writes. You know, I feel personally that when I write, when I'm writing, I'm a writer, and when I'm not writing, I'm not a writer. I mean, I'm someone who's talking about writing. Okay. So I tend not to talk much about that.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Where? Handsome hat, sir.
Thank you very much. It's got quite a story. Where are you? Where are you living now, and how's the affair going?
Good question. The affair ended, and badly. Read the book. Read Matches. I live in San Francisco. I live in San Francisco. I've been traveling a lot lately because of Matches, but I live in San Francisco. So, yes, ma'am.
Many years ago, I did go to Europe, and part of the trip was to Germany. When we were in Munich, walking along the street, a man came staggering out of a bar, supported by some friends. He took one look at us, and he spit out the dumped a unit.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yes. When I was at Dachau, she said that when she was in Munich with a group, she...
We were just a family walking.
A family walking along in the streets of Munich. Some drunken German gentleman stumbled out the bar and shouted at her or spit at her, what was the term?
Verdammte
Juden, which means something Jews. Verdammte. Damn Jews. And she wants to know, is that attitude still prevalent in Germany? Absolutely. I mean, prevalent. I mean, no self-respecting German is going to admit to those feelings, but when they get drunk, they show another side. When I was at Dachau, I saw them coming through the doors, the gates of the camp with their arms around each other's shoulders, singing soccer songs as they were going into the camps. There was a kind of happy, celebratory, drunken air to this, you know. Yes, ma'am.
I have another question about the Army. What was your experience with serving alongside female counterparts in the Israeli Army? Was there anything different that you'd like to share?
They kicked my butt. I have very, very high regard for Israeli women soldiers. I was trained in weaponry by Israeli women soldiers. You know, they're not on the front lines, although sometimes in encounters like with protests and things like that, sometimes Israeli women soldiers are there too. One of the toughest Israeli women soldiers I ever met was in the Israeli border police. She was in the border police, she was absolutely a tough cookie. And she went out, even though she was not supposed to, she pushed her way into the patrols that we went on in 2003 when we were around Jenin. And she would go in, and she was a tough cookie. I mean, I'm not trying to say that to be, you know, gracious to the ladies. She really was tough. So the attitude is of high regard, you know, towards the women soldiers overall.
That was our last question tonight. We're going to draw a close. Let's give a big hand to Alan Kaufman. And now this meeting of Inform and the Commonwealth Club is adjourned. Have a good evening.